Hey there, listeners. It's Matt here. My book, Career World, is out April 23rd. That is next week. I wrote the book with my good buddy, Dookie Hong. We've been working on it for several years, and it's all about modern Korean food around the world. There's a link in the show notes, or you can buy it at your favorite local bookstore. We're so proud of this book, and I really think you're going to love it. Career World, it's out April 23rd.
Maybe there's a reason people have gluten sensitivity because they've been consuming more gluten than our guts evolved to digest. And when you add vital wheat gluten just so it, you know, can rise fast and hold its form, I'm calling bullshit on that. That's not feeding the people well.
You're listening to The Taste Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Rodbard. Today on the show, I catch up with Ken Forkish, a prolific cookbook author behind works like Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast, Elements of Pizza, and Evolutions in Bread. We talked to Ken about moving from Portland, his home base for many decades, to Hawaii, of all places. He's baking in Hawaii. He's doing pizza pop-ups once a month. You should catch him there. We also get some of Ken's strong opinions about the bread world and about cooking in general. I really hope you enjoy this conversation with Ken Forkish. Ken Forkish, welcome to the Taste Podcast.
Hey, man, how are you?
It's great to see you. It is morning in your neck of the woods. It is late afternoon here. You live in Hawaii.
Yes, I do.
My goodness. How did you end up in Hawaii from Portland? We know you as a cookbook author, a master baker, a pizzolo based in Portland, Oregon, but now you are no longer there.
I've been coming to Hawaii for, it was my getaway. that place that I would come to restore and find peace again. The restaurant industry is challenging. It's hard. It's rewarding, but it really, it's consuming too, in good ways and not so good ways, for me anyway. So for about a dozen years, I would come to Hawaii, most of the islands, went Maui many times. I really liked Lanai. This is a beautiful island. But I think more than any other, I've been coming to the Big Island since, probably 2009, 2010, somewhere a couple times a year. And so the last couple of years, I just said, I really just want to live here full time. And that was also coincident with a period where I was getting close to having accomplished what I wanted to accomplish at my bakery and pizzeria in terms of product quality and sort of excising my creative demons.
Yeah.
So one thing led to another, and I don't know, the pandemic may have accelerated it, but I was kind of on this timeline anyway.
Yeah, you're easing your way out. Got to ask you, Umeke's on the Big Island, is that a poke place you go to at all?
I thought about going there for lunch yesterday because I was running errands in Kona and around there. I know it's super popular. I haven't been yet. Have you been? Do you know it?
Yeah, I love it. I've been many times. Many times meaning on the one time I was at the Big Island a few years ago before I went many times. No, I love that spot. And it was definitely a good rec from a friend. It's funny that you were going to go there. Is there a way to articulate Hawaiian cuisine for our audience? Because we don't speak with a lot of Hawaii natives.
I'm definitely not a Hawaii native, but
yeah.
As a resident,
resident.
Hawaiian cuisine is different than the Hawaiian tourist cuisine, which will have, but there's a lot of commonality too. For me, I got a great fish market 2 miles down from my house, and they're getting fish right off the boat. And it's, five or six kinds at least, whether it's ahi or ono or opakapaka or mahi-mahi or my favorite mahjong. Great Hawaiian shrimp and just an outstanding variety of super fresh fish. So I eat more fish than I eat meat. And then fruit, and especially things like papayas and mangoes and bananas. Man, that stuff is so great. And just to have it fresh year round is super awesome.
Ken, you look great. You look glowing. I mean, I can tell through the Zoom that you're glowing right now. It's got to be the papayas.
It's a lot of things.
It's a lot of things. Well, you know what? I was in Portland in August, and I went to both your bakery, your namesake bakery, and your namesake pizzeria. Obviously, you've divested and you're no longer there. But I have to say, at Ken's Artisan Bakery, I had a morning bun and chocolate chip cookie, and all was right in the world. I want to ask you, what was your last shift like at the bakery as the boss man?
You know, I stopped baking on production shifts around my 60th birthday. So I'm 64 mm-hmm. right now. And that was when I had my bakery at Trifecta. And, you know, part of me misses the act of baking. Part of me doesn't, because it's hard. It's not only hard. It means that I have to be in one place for 8 or 9 hours. And I like to be able to move around. It's weird. I've discovered that. It's sort of evolved as my daily rhythm 3 or 4 years ago was going to each of my four places every day. And I'd start by going to my bakery in the morning, and then I'd go to Checkerboard Pizza for around 11:30 in the morning to check in with staff and have a slice of pizza. And then in the evenings, you know, I drop in at Trifecta, have a cocktail, maybe some oysters, and then go to my pizzeria. And I got into this rhythm of movement every day in my work life, and then home office for, you know, office work. So being in one place all of a sudden for 8 or 9 hours to do a production shift was less enjoyable for me, because I just had to search somewhere else. Plus, my back was getting tired and my feet were sore.
Standing for all those years, baking breads, making your breads, must have taken its toll, and you're now rested. I mean, are you still baking or making pizza in a professional sense in Hawaii? Are you doing anything?
I bake both bread and pizza at home a couple times a week, typically. Cool. But I also have a gig at the Four Seasons Hualalai out of their golf course. It's just a happy hour event. They've got a mobile wood-fired oven, and I make pizza twice a month. And that's,
oh, my goodness.
That's as much as I want to do. Sometimes it's more than I want to do. but that's a real joy. I love making food for other people, and I love making my food. And this is nice because of me, instead of me having, you know, instructing staff on how to make food my way, just doing it myself, and serving it directly to people. I like that a lot. And it's
so really, twice a month, two shifts a month. And you clearly have to work, and you have to go through all the prep process, but are you pretty tired after those shifts these days, now that you're not really in it every day?
Yeah, a little bit. You can sort of lose your resilience and strength by not working and doing it every single day. But when I get in the car to drive home, mostly I'm just looking forward to a whiskey when I arrive at my house.
Yeah, absolutely. You get the reward.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk about your writing, because obviously listeners of our show know you from your cookbooks. Your cookbooks, Portland residents know about you from your restaurants, but most of us know about you from your cookbooks. And Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast just celebrated its 10th birthday. So I have two questions about this book. What's the legacy of the book, first off? And second, is there anything you would change 10 years later in a new edition if you were given the opportunity?
Well, that was my point with Evolutions in Bread, which just published more or less on the anniversary of Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast. Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast did what I really, it achieved its goal. It was really satisfying, because that's not always going to be the case, right?
No, so definitely not.
You know, what I tried to do with Evolutions in Bread 10 years later is I think a little bit differently as a baker than I did 10 years prior. And when I wrote Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast, it was my first cookbook. So I hadn't had that 10 years of feedback from readers that, you know, it comes usually on social media, you know, that I've received now. So it gave me an opportunity to see it from the home baker's point of view, and maybe change a little bit about how I write. But I think the biggest change was how I use a Levain culture. So in my first book, I used a very traditional amount of flour to refresh and feed the Levain. Most people would use 1,000 grams of flour or 500 grams of flour. And it's more flour than you need. But at the time I wrote it, you know, I wasn't confident that everybody would be using flour that had enough flora in it to really work. And I wanted the recipe to work, and it did. And so I didn't have any regrets. But a lot of people felt like it was excess flour, because you have to throw a certain amount of the sourdough away before the next feeding. And then a lot of people are saying, well, you should never have to throw any of it away. And I'm like, you know, if you want, you know, my goal is to produce a bread that tastes good. And there's a certain ratio of retained culture and then new flour and water when you go to feed it. And if that ratio changes where the amount of retained culture is high and you're just adding a little bit of flour, it's going to get super sour. And that's not desirable to me. So whether it was in flour, water, salt, yeast, or evolutions of bread, the overriding guidance was to have bread that tasted really good and rose really nicely. But in evolutions in bread, I tasked myself with finding the most flour efficient way to do it. And I thought I was able to achieve that by reducing the amount of flour it takes to both start a culture and then feed it and maintain it by,
I mean,
I don't know, like 80, 90%. That's
wow. And much. And your book exploded in popularity during the pandemic and it was off shelves. I mean, it sold out. And I think you wrote in Evolutions in Bread about making a flour efficient sourdough recipe.
Yeah.
I mean, they have to go hand in hand. We were having flour shortages, which is kind of crazy to think. I mean, did you ever think we would have flour shortages in our country?
I mean, you only hope no, but you know, you live enough decades, you realize bad things can happen.
Yeah.
Whether it's like, you know, when I was 14 years old, there were lines for gasoline and there are even odd days. So, on, you know, the even days could get gas on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
Yeah.
And the days could get on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, you know. Obviously that was in the, during the pandemic though, stores ran out of yeast and ran out of flour. But when people were able to buy flour and no yeast, they started doing sourdough. And then that's when I most sorely felt the need to write about a more flour efficient way to do Levain. And that's when I started working on Evolutions in Bread.
Very cool. And you wrote that during the pandemic. What was that process like, developing recipes and writing during the pandemic? Did you find you had more focus because you were writing during the pandemic?
I wouldn't say entirely, because my bakery and my pizzeria only closed for 2 months. Mm-hmm. Everybody closed more or less on March 16th, 2020. Yeah. That was the day. But they both reopened end of May that year. So very quickly, I was engaged with my businesses, trying to figure out how to reopen and operate and staff safely. So I didn't have a ton of downtime. Anyway, I just squeezed it in, to be honest.
Yeah, you squeezed it. So yeah, you didn't have those, like, I know some chefs who wrote books during the period because they were out of work or just like had more time, but it makes sense.
Plus, you know, we were all scrambling for money. Out if we were going to survive, and then there's PPP and all that stuff. So
yeah,
the office work part was a lot. And then just trying to figure things out. Like, you know, when you've had a business running for, you know, like the bakery at that point had been running for 18 years, almost 19 years. It was, everything was set and established and somebody would leave, you'd hire someone else and it would keep running the same way. You didn't have to reinvent how you did it. But in the pandemic, it was a complete reorganization of how the place operated with a much smaller staff to go only kind of deal. And that was a lot of work to figure out and make happen.
Mm-hmm. What does the term sour bro mean to you?
I've never heard that term until you mentioned it. What does it mean to you?
Oh my gosh, so this is great. So I know during the pandemic, there were a couple thinky pieces written by publications about, first, the boom in sourdough baking, bread baking, obsession with bread baking, all great things. But then there was this kind of shift in the tone and about how sourdough became this kind of thing that bros, I don't want to gender it at all, but bros who kind of were into like maybe other things, like maybe collecting watches or sports or cars or whatever, were kind of in getting into this bread baking thing. All the toys were being bought to make bread. There was maybe like a tech element to it. So like this idea of the sour bro kind of popped up, like this idea of this new home cooker, new baker coming from a different demographic who hadn't maybe been baking that much. I'm not saying it's a good or bad thing. I just know it was a comment being made. So it's interesting that you've not heard about this term.
Oh, I hate the term. It's really misogynistic. I don't like it at all. I mean, to be honest. So...
no,
next question.
Yeah, it's a weird question. But let me just expand it a little bit more and just say new audiences of bakers, right, who bought your book, who had a little more time. I mean, we've seen it from the coverage, what we read about in Taste, like home cooking certainly shifted a lot. obviously people got exhausted from home cooking, but there was a lot of discovery. So did you see this as well? I'll also add pizza making too, of course, became huge. And you've written extensively about pizza as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big change in the pizza home pizza making circuit of, you know, now everybody's using the Uni and Rockbox and, you know, the other home high temperature, whether they're gas fired or wood fired pizza ovens. I think that's awesome. And it's really changed the landscape. When I wrote The Elements of Pizza, those devices had just hit the market because I authored that in 2014 and 15. It published in 2016. Mm-hmm. And they were just hitting the market. And I didn't write about that because I'm thinking, you know, I'm not going to dedicate a segment of the book to something that is, you know, such a tiny percentage of the readers, but that percentage has grown dramatically. They seem to be very successful businesses. And since I moved to Hawaii, I bought an Uni Koda that I love. You know, I miss having a wood-fired oven. You know, anytime I wanted to, I had one in my house, I had one at work. But the pizza world has changed a lot. High temp baking takes a little bit different dough than home kitchen ovens. You know, will get up to 500 to 550 degrees, and that's what I wrote my dough recipes for and techniques for. But the high temp ovens, and this kind of goes back to the sour bro kind of thing, is a lot of people now that they've got ovens that can bake at 850, 950 degrees, think that the best way and the most braggadocio way to make pizza is to bake it at the very highest temp possible. And that's not the pizza I love. You know, the pizza I make at, well, at Ken's Artisan Pizza, I'd say our average bake temp is about 800 degrees in the oven. There's a big difference between the temperature too at the back of the pie that's facing the fire and the front of the pie that's facing the mouth of the oven is probably going to be about 100 degrees difference between those two points, which is why you got to rotate the pie a lot. And if you've got one of the 12-inch, like a Rockbox, or Uni makes 12-inch too, it's really, you can't turn it within the oven. You got to pull it out, turn it by hand, put it back in.
That's got to be a change for you, using an Uni. I can't imagine you using an Uni, but you got to.
I do, and I'm making really good pizza, and I post it on Instagram, and I eat it, and it's a really good pizza. So at least I can still get pizza that way. When people want to convert my recipes to bake in those high temp ovens, they need to reduce the hydration to about 64-65% in the dough, and it'll handle just fine. Because, you know, I talked about how you got to rotate. If you try to do that too soon, your peel's going to puncture the dough on the bottom. And
it's the worst. Yeah. Well, when you puncture sucks. And it leaks all over the deck, and you're kind of sad face right there.
But, you know, why? I think a lot of people are baking based on metrics that they think they're supposed to bake at 900 degrees. And it's like, it's your pizza. I mean, you know,
yeah.
Bake the way you want, not the way somebody else tells you should do. And I like a crisper crust. I like the dough baked all the way through. I used to bake around 750, 800 degrees. And then I'm pretty
You heard it here from Ken Forkish. It's great advice. Ken, how have you seen pizza as a whole change over the years, for good or for bad? You've been following the industry. You wrote a book about pizza.
Oh, Lord.
But pizza is more popular than ever.
Isn't that awesome? I mean, pizza is such a great food, but I think what's happened is that there's a much greater understanding of pizza in our culture. I can't speak for any other culture than American. And I want to take a little credit for that, but
you should.
It's not just me. It's, you know, it's guys like Mark Bevetri and, you know, Chris Bianco and others who've written just really, you know, some pizza cookbooks at home. All of us had desirable, often hard to get into pizza restaurants. You know, I want a Mark Vetri pizza, and I can't get in, you know, blah, blah, blah. Of course, we want people to stand in line and wait.
Yeah. Oh, you got to have a
line. Much better knowledge of pizza. There's there are a lot more good quality pizzerias out there than there were 10 years ago or 20 years ago. The elevation of pizza knowledge in the United States is much higher than it was. Our access to ingredients is very good. And just a generally accepted understanding among a lot of people who are makers of how to do it well. When, you know, 10 years ago, how many places were making pizza that had that leoparded crust? And like nobody, pretty much.
Yeah.
If you did, you know, it would be like measles on a crust. People would say, I don't really like that.
It's burned. It's burned.
Yeah, well, I heard that too. But yeah, you know, we didn't even, our crust, to get that leopardine, you need extended fermentation. So, you know, that started with the project I already told you about just a few years ago, and a fairly high baking temperature, 750 to 800 minimum baking temperature. Yeah. You need those two things in concert. And I don't think that was very well understood until 5 or 10 years ago.
Until, I mean, Roberta's, you got to give them some credit for introducing that style.
Sure. So, you know, it's just a different world now in pizza. And I think a lot of people can take credit for the elevation of the knowledge. But then, you know, there's a lot of bootstrap chefs out there who saw ingredient costs is lower, labor costs is lower. I can actually make a living if I make really good pizza. And that's much harder to do in a traditional restaurant.
Margin is wonderful in pizzerias. And also it's kind of pandemic proof. It's kind of recession proof, right?
It is. I remember being in Italy talking to people there. They said, yeah, it was the one restaurant that will always survive a recession is a pizzeria.
Yeah. What do you think about pizza in the pan? Are you a fan of cooking pizza in a pan?
I grew up eating pan pizza. I like pizza in very many styles. And so, as a matter of fact, when I was a kid, my brother, when he was a teenager, he worked at a place called The Pizza Pan.
So cool.
It's, you know, not... it's been around for a very long time.
Okay, so you gave the keynote at the Pizza Expo in Las Vegas this past summer.
How did
that go, and what did you tell these pizzolos from around the world? What did they learn from you?
I thought it went really well. I was nervous, but I thought it went really well. I'd never addressed an audience of hundreds of people before.
Yeah.
Yeah, at the International Pizza Expo in Vegas, it's the second largest food trade show in the country. And there's a lot of Italians, there's people from South America, from Japan, from all over the United States. It's a huge event, and it was a real honor to be asked to be a keynote there. And I wanted to tell a story that would be not just pablum, but not just stuff that everybody parrots, but, you know, something unique to my business and what worked for me. And essentially the theme of my talk was I had to break it to fix it. And I was talking about my own pizzeria, and we had, you know, I opened Ken's Artisan Pizza in 2006. And after, especially after writing The Elements of Pizza and spending a lot of time in Italy with really great pizzaiolos and the Caputo flour people and the guy who made the tomatoes and mozzarella di bufala, all that, you know, it really evolved my thinking about pizza. And it just percolated in my mind for a long time that there were changes I wanted to make to our pizza, the pizza that we made at my place. And I wanted much longer fermented dough, and I wanted to change the way we did our sauce, and I wanted to hand make our mozzarella, cut it differently.
Wow.
Things. And I was actually, there was some institutional malaise at the pizzeria. We'd had long-term staff, but just, they didn't really want to do it. And, ultimately I had to, rebuild the team. And,
when you talk about a long fermented dough at a pizzeria, I mean, that's really hard to do that because it's a high volume game and you're always in debt for dough, right? You're always waiting, you know, you're selling out of dough. How do you make that adjustment for longer? Are we talking like 72 hour ferments and stuff like that?
Close. I found our best dough balls were 2 days in the fridge.
Okay.
So how do you adjust? Well, you start by buying new refrigerators or additional refrigeration.
Additional, right? Yeah. You need more space physically, right? Of course.
Exactly. But we had that. And then I needed to basically game it. I needed to have a staff that was on board. So that's why I said the theme of my talk was I had to break it to fix it. And, you know, I hated to get up there and say, you know, I had to fire some people to bring in a team that would actually work with me, but it was my pizzeria. And, you know, I knew what I wanted and I knew it could be better. I also knew that I wasn't going to be doing this for another 10 or 20 years. I had my own timeline in my head that, I said, I'm probably, you know, no more than 5 years from now. So I really want to leave with a pizza at our very best place. And I did. And, you know, at the end of the day, when I went back to Portland a few weeks ago and had dinner at my pizzeria, and that staff was still in place. Well, Vince, our chef, had just returned from Naples, where Ken's Artisan Pizza was selected number 57 in the world.
After
getting number 11 in the United States. This is by an Italian company called 50 Top Pizza.
And oh yeah, I voted in that several times.
Did you?
I've definitely. Oh yeah, oh. Not this year. I did not vote this year, but I know what that is, exactly what that is.
So anyway, I felt vindicated in a way.
Absolutely,
it was really hard for me to make those changes. And yeah, this goes back to 2017 when I started to make the staffing changes to get us where we needed to be. And there was a lot of resistance because the business was really good. We weren't hurting at all. And no, and there was some disruptions, and our business went down for a while because I wasn't able to immediately bring back or staff it properly. So
what did you order when you're in the restaurant that holds your name, but you're not really there day to day? You're there spiritually with the name.
It's so hard.
Let's talk about that. What's the vibe like? You're sitting in the dining room. What are you ordering? What's going through your mind?
Well, first off, I'm facing the kitchen. My dining partner's facing the other way. So I can watch what's going on. But there's so many things I wanted to order. And so, we had like four appetizers and, more pizzas than we had people sitting at the table. Usually if I'm only ever going to be able to have one pizza there, it'll be a margarita. And then I'll get a side of prosciutto.
Pizza.
I love our sopressata pizza. I love our veggie pies.
You have those beautiful prosciuttos there, and I read your exit interview with Karen Brooks, great Portland journalist, and it seems that you've sold the businesses to longtime employees, or that was your intention. I'm not sure if that's what happened.
That is what happened in my bakery. Theo and Randy had a combined 30-some years of working experience there, and they'd been in management there for a long time. So Randy was our pastry chef, and Theo was our general manager, who was also our lunch chef, and managed the wholesale business. And between the two of them, they really knew how everything worked at the place. And it was good for me because I wanted continuity. I wanted to be physically gone, but I wanted the bakery to remain the same. And same at Ken's Artisan Pizza. I sold it to Peter Kost, who's an excellent restaurant operator. And he knows food and he's done a fantastic job. So it was really rewarding to go back 9 months later, a couple weeks ago, and the kitchen team was all still there, the front of house staff was all still there, the bar staff,
man,
our hosts, there had been hardly any turnover.
And you could show your face. You didn't get like, you were booted out of town. I'm joking, of course, but this does happen.
Oh man. can you imagine though? Like, devoting your life to a place for decades and then you can't even show up, that'd be awful.
It would be awful, and I think it happens more than you'd think, I would imagine, just because restaurant business is tough, and when it comes to equity
I know it happens. But it was great to be back, and I look forward to going back again.
Switching gears, we wrote an article about you, about your new book on taste, and one of the quotes that you had, I really wanted to follow up with you on it, and it's, let's look at the ingredient list on a loaf of standard, multi-grain bread, quotes, like that's supposed to be the good stuff. But you've said clearly that you would be shocked if you knew what those ingredients meant. What does that mean exactly?
These are breads that are made in very large bakeries that are built for a long shelf life. So they'll have dough conditioners and things that go beyond flour, butter, salt, and yeast. My first book was titled that way for a reason, because I wanted to show people how good bread can be when it's made with only its traditional ingredients. Multigrain sticks basically with those traditional ingredients. I used oats, I used buckwheat, and I used barley. And so multigrain, true to its, to its name, it does not have added wheat gluten or vital wheat gluten, which is there to allow for the dough to hold its rise when it's got all the stuff in it, and for fast rise, and something that's used in industrial baking, but it does nothing to add to the flavor of the bread. Makes it harder for you to digest because you got to break down more gluten in your belly. And if you just look at the ingredients label and ask yourself, if you don't know what it is, do you want to eat it? And you know, I apply that to everything. So I guess you can tell I didn't raise a family of children. It's kind
of difficult to take. Yeah, I mean, it is a difficult task not to try to define every ingredient. But the point is well taken. And I think I'd like to ask as a follow-up, how do we actually buy commercial bread if we do have a family or we can't make it to a bakery? I mean, we've got these brands that kind of tout, like, you know, Sprouted this or Killer this, Dave's Killer.
Well, Dave's Killer Bread's a great example. Vital Wheat Gluten is, a long time ago, I read an article or an interview with David. He was talking about he couldn't make his breads without that. And I'm like, dude, this is not good. This is really not good. Maybe there's a reason people have gluten sensitivity because they've been consuming more gluten than our guts evolved to digest. And when you add Vital Wheat Gluten just so it, you know, can rise fast and hold its form, you know, I'm calling bullshit on that. That's not feeding the people well.
Yeah, it's strong words, and I appreciate that because I think we oftentimes get marketed bread, like lots of things, like the word organic, like the word fair trade coffee, the term that fair trade coffee, like we get marketed these terms and we don't really know what they're doing to our bodies. So how do I buy good bread at the grocery store if I don't have that bakery down the street, which some of us, you know, many listeners don't have?
I'm not really the person to answer that question because I would say that the answer isn't how do you buy good bread at the store? It's how do you make bread at home that has integrity in its ingredients and it tastes good, but it's not a lot of work. And that was really the mission behind Evolutions in Bread is how to make a multigrain at home, how to make a whole wheat bread at home, how to make white bread, brioche at home, without it being a lot, you know, very much work. And that's what I tried to achieve. I think I did.
I'm glad you came back to that point because I was leading you a bit towards that because I think making bread at home is the answer. And also making bread at home isn't as difficult as you may think. You may not get the perfect, you know, skin or the perfect, you know, crumb.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be perfect. And, right. You know, it gets better every time you do it. And, you know, when I'm writing in my books, my instructions, it's a little heady, but I'm just assuming that this is not a one-time thing. You know, you're going to do this recipe, and then I always write, next time you do it, you know, adjust based on this or that.
Well, it's fun. I mean, and it goes back to like our pandemic bread baking obsession. It was actually a fun thing to do when we had a lot of not fun things in our lives, right? Baking bread is fun.
Yeah, and if you have children, wouldn't you want to engage your kids in that? Absolutely. So, you know, when I was specifically riffing on multigrain bread and in Evolutions in Bread and about its ingredients, it's like, would you rather feed your family bread that is based on these ingredients that you know that you bought or with all this stuff in it, you don't really know what it is?
Let's talk about your writing practice, Ken. Are you developing recipes constantly? Are you kind of putting in that work as like a multi-cookbook author? Are you thinking about another cookbook or are you just writing for fun?
I'm not writing for fun. I'm a big reader. So, and I like readers, you know, I search out authors that are, you know, like I'm rereading Gabrielle Hamilton's Blood, Bones and Butter. And gosh, she's such a great writer. I could never, to be a great writer, you have to be a really great thinker. And she is that. In terms of any future projects, I'm doing an adaptation of Evolutions in Bread in comic book form
with
Sarah Bakan, who did Let's Make Ramen and Let's Make Dumplings. And we just finished our draft last month, and that'll be a lot of fun to, I think it's about a year out on that one.
So exciting. Is that with 10 Speed?
Yeah, that's 10 Speed Press.
Wonderful. Yeah. Can't wait to see that one. Well, we ask all guests in the Taste Podcast, if you could write a cookbook or food culture book without the burden of time, meaning you don't have a deadline, or the burden of budget, meaning you have unlimited money to get the book done, Ken, what would that book be?
Oh, man, I think I've already written three of those. And the experience I had after writing Flour, Water, Salt, Yeast, Elements of Pizza, and Evolutions in Bread was I feel kind of spent. And so the creative Jones has been pretty well satisfied for me. It'd probably take me a few years before I have that spark. And each one was not an intentional, I need to write a new book. What book am I going to write? It was the spark of the idea drove the creation of the book. And I can never, you know, who can define when that next spark's going to come or whether it's going to be even valid enough to to act upon it.
I'm gonna bet on it happening. I'm gonna bet on you writing something else because I just know you have it in you. Ken Forkish, thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
Pleasure was mine. Thanks, Matt.
Matt, so you just came back from Korea. I want to hear all about it. What were you doing there? Who were you with? What did you eat? Tell me it all.
I was there recording nothing. I don't know why I said recording. I was recording interviews with a lot of people for our book, Korea World. I was there with Dookie Hong, who I'm writing this book with, and then Alex Lau, who's also a co-author and photographing the book. So we were lucky to go back to Korea. We were there last fall and around the same time in November, and we made a return trip this time. So we're working on the book. We're kind of reporting about Seoul and many of the areas surrounding Seoul. But this trip in particular, I had some breakthroughs with Seoul, and I want to get into that a bit later. But in general, we were in Seoul. Then we flew down to Jeju Island, which is like the Hawaii of Korea. We spent a little time in Gwangju, and then we went back to Seoul. And then on the last day, we went up to Gangwon-do, which is where the Olympics were in 2018 and has its own kind of flair and flavor.
So you were bopping all over the place a little bit, it seems like.
I landed and I ended up in Seoul. So like Seoul to me has changed. This is my sixth trip to Korea, and I feel like I know Seoul better than ever, but it asks so many more questions of me, right?
Yeah, like what?
One thing is like, what is going on with coffee and bakeries? Because right now in Seoul, I was really focusing on a lot of the traditional cuisine and something I've been covered for over a decade. A lot of the traditional foods that you'll find in Koreatowns around America, around the world, the chigaes, the kimchis, the namuls, the tangs, the jims, all the classics that we love talking about. But for us, this trip in particular, I wanted to get a sense of what was happening in modern Seoul in terms of this cross between Western and Eastern cuisine. And two things that struck me were the bakeries and the coffee culture, which have exploded exponentially in the past couple years. And I found myself eating more kugunamon and croissants and sandwiches and jambon beurre than I was actually kimbap and kimchi jjigae at times, of course. So that was really interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Do you feel like it's like a big laminated pastry moment based on what you're saying? Are there like things that you expect to see at all of the coffee shops, or is it a mix?
Definitely a big focus on lamination and croissants. I think you're walking through the streets and you're smelling croissant baking, that rich butter baking smell everywhere. I mean, it's almost like the way Subway in America blasts out the Subway smell. I feel like Korea in Seoul, many of the entrepreneurs have like realized, let's blast out croissant smell and let's bring in and bring in a bunch of new customers. Now, I'm going to back up a bit. Of course, bakeries are not new to Korea. Major chains like Tous Les Jours are there and ever present. And certainly in Korean culture, the idea of the bakery and the cafe as a place to socialize and hang out is not new. But what I really am seeing is just this exceptional dedication to craft that I think many food writers, especially in America, they fetishize Japan for having craft, and as they should. Japan is incredible craft. But we have to look at Seoul and Korea for definitely this level of craft that is not maybe covered as much. And Liza, I want to call out a couple places in particular that I found really interesting baked goods. Because I really, you run, Cake Zine, and you're on the pastry beat and have do amazing coverage of the baking world and through culture. So I thought of you from this one place. I thought of you. It's called Tongue Planet. It's crazy. It's so cool. There's a Korean fashion line or retail line called Adder Error, and it's Adder Error's cafe. And this is in the Songsu neighborhood where I spent a ton of time. And Songsu is a neighborhood that is adjacent to Seoul Forest. Many have called it the Bushwick of Seoul. It has a lot of a concentration of design focused retail. So Adder Error is doing an incredible concept store there. But Tongue Planet is their second level cafe, and they've got these cakes that I'll call it, they're decorated with the most, I would say, demonic squiggly face designs that I've ever seen on a pastry.
A demonic cake, that's what you're saying. I love that.
Well, it's like demonic, like squiggly faces, and these cakes are individual serve cakes, and like a lot of these bakeries, high-end bakeries in Korea, and also as seen at Lycée in New York City, there's a bit of a studio element. You're walking in and you're seeing all the pastries lined up on a table. There's kind of like display versions of these cakes, and so you can like see them in their form and then order them. So I think it's definitely a very Korean way of presenting cake. So I love Tongue Planet for the cakes, but I also love this place, Meal Degree. It's also in Songsu. And I have to say, one of my grails in life is peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in East Asia. And I found in Japan, I've been to Japan a number of times, I've had the most incredible, you know, milk bread, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And I found one in Korea that is the better than anyone I've ever had in my life.
Wow. What made it so much better than the rest? Because those all sound delicious to me. It's just as a concept. I feel like that fluffy bread and creamy peanut butter must be just inherently delicious.
Inherently. And I think what's happened is it's incredibly fresh and beautiful milk bread sliced perfectly on the diagonal, kind of shoved into plastic, the same that you'd see at 7-Eleven in Japan or Korea. But for some reason, the peanut butter, the quality of the peanut butter was high. And it's interesting. I was traveling a bit, and I was at a couple of hotels that were serving peanut butter. And you're not finding great peanut butter in Korea. You're finding this kind of artificial, very lightweight whipped peanut butter. And you know, certainly nothing that's like Jif, which I feel is the gold standard. We can definitely talk about that at length. For industrial peanut butter. But I just thought they had a really good peanut butter and I loved it so much.
I love that. I also think we could talk about peanut butter at a later date for an extended period of time.
Definitely.
But I'm curious, was there a third place on your list?
For bakeries, I'm actually writing a piece for Why Is This Interesting? It may drop before or after about cafe culture or coffee culture in Seoul, and I'll make sure to link to that in the show notes. But so coffee is its own incredibly exciting thing in Seoul, and I'll write about that in the book as well. But for bakeries, I mean, I gotta say, I went to a place, Voila Cafe in Gangwon-do, in Sokju, which is a cool town on the ocean, and I had probably my fifth burnt cheesecake slice of the trip.
I love that it's that many options, that this is your fifth one.
Well, I went on a little sampling crawl over the course, but this was the best one. And, you know, the Basque cheesecake, the burnt cheesecake, has really taken off in Korea. You're going to see it everywhere, as well as Dalgona candy, which if you've watched Squid Game, you know there's an important scene related to Dalgona candies, but it's very, very, and that's like a burnt sugar candy that we're working on a recipe for Korea World about that. But burnt cheesecake was really great at this place, Voila Cafe, and on the boardwalk in Sokju.
That sounds great. And I'm curious about your trip down to Jeju Island also, because that's a place I've been interested in going to for a while. What was that like?
Yeah, well, Eliza, you know, Jeju to me was always a place that I wanted to go. And I felt I was lucky enough to go on a tour with Dookie Hung. He was leading it with some cool folks, and we got to spend a few days in Jeju. And it was through with Chima Travels, who's a great operator of trips and tours. She had been there a few times, but I really gotta say, it's a beautiful place, and I didn't quite get to experience the food that I wanted to, but I got to try two of the local, I would say, delicacies or local favorites. One is the black pork, Jeju black pork, which is like samgyeopsal. It's grilled on a cast iron griddle. And it's kind of like, most of the time, pork in Korea is a little more of like the kind of flatter, like porky, but less porky industrial stuff, which is great when you're like drinking soju and you want to have a nice barbecue experience, but it doesn't have a lot of porkiness. The Jeju black pork tastes more like Berkshire, In the States, it has a little more of that deeper, gamier flavor, and it's a little bit tougher. But I think I liked it better. So I enjoy Jeju black pork.
That pork sounds so good. And I'm curious if you got to spend any time hanging out with the Hanyo divers while you were there, because that's something that I'm definitely curious in seeing for myself.
So Eliza, it's Hanyo are the older female divers that have now recently become part of pop culture and cultural lore of Jeju. And it's really exciting. In a pretty patriarchal society, I would call the Hanyo a burst of feminism and female empowerment that I think is exciting for many in Korea. And I think there's a lot of pride around the Hanyo. I have witnessed and been with Hanyo on location, but not this trip. I was in Korea in 2014 with the chef Edward Lee and the reality star Audrina Patridge. It is a long story for another day. I love both of them dearly. They're both very cool people. And on that trip, I got to see Hanyo diving and harvesting abalone and some other shellfish, and that was great. But on this trip, Hanyo have become a little more, I would call them scarce. They're there more as like furthering the knowledge of the Hanyo than actually diving, though I'm sure in all throughout Korea there are working Hanyo, of course. It just becomes less, it's more rare.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I guess I think they're probably a tourist attraction on the island in some way as well, which makes sense, just considering like how historic that tradition is, and also the way that people have been getting seafood over time, I'm sure has changed.
Absolutely. And, you know, Eliza, there's a beautiful museum dedicated to the Hanyo that we went to that I really liked, and it really traces the history of the Hanyo on the island and how Hanyo plays such an important role in Korean culture. And as I said, it's a breath of fresh air seeing female empowerment this way. And I think maybe later on there will be a moment where Hanyo will be – there'll be more of like a younger generation of Hanyo. But I think the work is so difficult that it's challenging to recruit new Hanyo because the work is extremely hard.
Yeah, if anyone listening isn't familiar, it's definitely a fun internet – rabbit hole to fall down. These women are basically deep sea diving without any equipment or any like protective clothing, to my understanding, in this cold water, and they're harvesting all of the bounty of the ocean or around the island. So it is a really long-standing tradition that is hugely difficult, I think, and requires a lot of training and ability.
Correct, Eliza. It's absolutely right. Thanks for doing the abridged version. I appreciate that. I think one thing that I'm want to point out is that it's not only seafood. Hanyo are actually harvesting seaweed, kim. So that's one big part of the Hanyo kind of harvest and experience too. But I highly recommend visiting Jeju. And I was going to say the other item I had, which Jeju is known for, and I wasn't the biggest fan, is horse. So they have a tradition of serving horse. On the island, they say Mongols brought horses to the island back when Mongols were ruling. And I tried at a restaurant many types of horse. I had a UK style of horse, which is like an icy, frozen, raw version of horse with, Asian pears. I also had a jjim, which is like a steamed or braised horse. And then I had grilled horse as well. And I have to say, I have very little opinion about the flavor because there wasn't much, at least in the horse that we tried.
I was going to ask if you had a favorite preparation of horse, but it seems like maybe you didn't like any of them.
You know, I don't want to like undersell horse as a food because I have a sample size of one place. But honestly, I can't recommend it. I did find out some things about the actual meat and the way it's harvested. It's interesting. So it's not like wild horse. There's a farm that the owner goes to. They harvest one horse a week for this restaurant. They are between 1 and 2 years old, and they are bred for meat. So it has less muscle than a working horse.
And is there a specific like body part of the horse that's like extra prized, or are you eating like all of the different parts of it?
No, it's not nose to tail pony that we're going for here. It's not. I think my understanding, and I asked that question as well, and in translation, it wasn't quite clear, but we're talking about the working muscles of the horse. It's not necessarily the offal. This does remind me of a previous trip to Korea. I went to Pohang, which is a coastal city that is known for steel production, and I was treated to a very costly and rare whale omakase style meal, like a tasting of whale. Now that, Eliza, was it nose to tail, I guess, or yeah, I guess whales have tails, nose to tail whale eating.
Wow, I'm just processing that because I remember, you know, I grew up in Los Angeles and there was a huge scandal when I was growing up that one of the sushi restaurants down by the water was serving whale kind of off the menu. But I guess in, you know, all over the world, people are eating different kinds of things in different places. So that's totally valid.
Well, I wish I could speak clearly about the validity of the harvest of this whale. I still think it's very problematic. Whales are endangered species and the harvesting of whale is extremely violent and I'm not a fan of it. I wanted to try it. I was a guest and I did not want to be rude. It does sound extremely douchey to serve whale in Southern California too. So I'll co-sign on that. But the bottom line about whale is it's awful tasting. It was awful tasting. And I'll say this, it is a cross between mammal and marine. And you really don't want to eat a lamb times salmon ever in your life. It's basically lamb crossed with salmon. Think about that for a second.
Chicken of the sea, it's not.
It's not chicken of the sea. It's basically lamb brains of the sea. I had breast. I had whale tongue. I had blubber. I had raw. I had braised. I had grilled. It was never ending. I was sitting on the floor. It was not a great experience, but I'm glad I have it for at least a story and maybe to write about one day.
Yeah, it sounds like quite the experience, and this trip sounds like quite the special trip. I'm curious, you know, this has been, what, your seventh trip to Korea, your sixth trip to Korea? Like, what are your tips for people that are maybe planning a trip, maybe they got a nice flight deal recently, mm-hmm. or they're just planning on coming out to Korea? Like, what would you recommend?
Great question, Eliza. I think a couple tips, and I'll have to say we're recording this in late November, and the dollar is extremely strong in Korea against the won, and I think that it was a 30% discount from a year ago, and if those prices maintain, please book a flight and get to Korea this winter. Winter is a great time to go. It's cold, but it's dry, and it's very pretty. Summer is extremely humid and rainy, and there's definitely more tourists there. One tip I have is really first. One tip I have is like definitely get Kakao Tea or Kakao Taxi on your phone and sign up for Kakao. Google is not widely used in Korea, so there's less, and Uber is hard to find. So getting a Kakao Tea is important to get around. But really, you're gonna find extremely easy moments in the trip. You're gonna find difficult moments. This is my sixth trip. I've been going there for over a decade, and English is more prominent than ever. But still, you have to kind of know what you're getting into. Luckily, there's great resources online, and there's lots of great follows on social media. Doobie Doo Bop is one. Tina Choi, who I had on the podcast recently, is a great follow. James E. Park, Irene Yu, all Americans who go to Korea often and are great follows and have great lists. But one tip I have is really, like any major city, get some great walking shoes and hit the pavement and walk around. And one neighborhood I love is Sangsu. I mentioned it. It's definitely more of the Bushwick of Korea, or of Seoul. That's just kind of a general term. But there's a lot of cool things happening, designer shops, but also really interesting restaurants and culture happening there. I love going south to Apujang, and that's a great neighborhood not far from Gangnam, which everyone knows from the song, but is more of a fluent neighborhood. But Apujang is also has a real south of the river vibe. And then north of the river, I've always enjoyed my time in Itaewon. I've enjoyed my time in Mapo and Hongdae. But there's so many great neighborhoods in Seoul. It's worth a week alone. As I said, I was reporting on Korea World, and we'll have plenty of resources in the book about where to visit in Seoul.
Well, those all sound great. You're inspiring me to go check my Google flights right after this.
Check.
So thanks for the rundown.
Thanks, Eliza. It's great catching up with you and talking about one of my favorite places to visit, if not my very favorite place to visit. And thanks for asking great questions. The Taste Podcast is hosted by me, Matt Rodbard. It's produced by Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. Theme music by Steve Rydell. Visit Taste online at tastecooking.com and make sure to subscribe to our newsletter. Thanks for listening.